Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. If y'all are like us, you've exhausted everywhere else you find your documentaries on the strange and unusual and the fun. And if you like grand conspiracies and more breakaway societies, paranormal, ancient civilizations like we all do, and UFOs, well, we've found the place right at your fingertips, folks. You can stream videos from anywhere, from your living room or on the go, with access to over 7,000 titles, all on Gaia.com, G-A-I-A. Now, you can get this for a monthly plan of $9.95 a month. Your first month will only be 99 cents. Now, there is a three-month plan and an annual plan. So, if you're into the things that we're into, and judging by what you're listening to, you are, start enjoying Gaia.com. Expand your perspective even more. G-A-I-A.com. Howdy there, friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, folks, it's me, Cam, and as always, sitting across the table from me, trying to stay warm today as we record this, is Kyle Filio Filson. His native northern blood has failed him today.
How's it going, everybody? I'm thrilled to be here. Yeah, man, it's a bit nippy out, right?
Man, I know everybody got hit with it. It came upon us when you talk it. It was 72 Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Down into the teens later on.
Yeah, my office is about, I'd say 30 minutes from where I live. And I left my office coming home, and it was 62 degrees when I got in my car, because it's got a thermometer that measures the outside temperature on the inside.
He has a baby thermometer hot glued to the outside of the car so he can read it.
And from the time I drove from my office in Fort Worth to my house, 30 minutes. It had dropped 25 degrees.
Right.
And I was like, whoa. I mean, I knew the front was coming, but I didn't know it would be so quick. And also, it was about 5 hours earlier than what they said it would be.
Yeah.
I was expecting it to drop, you know, in the middle of the night, like 1 a.m. or something.
That's what they were calling for.
No.
No, it had different plans.
Yeah, it was cold.
And here's something else, folks, just so you always want to know about what me and Kyle's life is like, how exciting it's been for us. You know, it always feels like we're always happy and having fun. We're always happy to be here. Well, Kyle's car blew up, so he's going to have to get a new vehicle right here before Christmas.
Yeah, awesome timing, right?
Yeah.
I love having to buy a new vehicle right at Christmas.
And first of all, we got to explain everything. Me and Kyle don't drive new cars. We don't ever buy new cars, folks. We buy used vehicles. We refuse to buy new vehicles. They depreciate. I'm not going to throw my money into that. I'd rather just, if I'm going to waste my money, I'm going to waste it on something fun.
Well, I drive all day, every day for my job. And so, there's no point in putting that kind of mileage on a good, nice new car. So I always buy commuters, beaters, you know.
Yeah.
This one that blew up, I mean, I had 348,000 miles on it.
Yeah.
The one I had before that, I had 430,000 miles on it.
When you sold that one.
I sold it, and it didn't even blow up. But I still think there's a guy around town that's still driving the thing.
Yeah. And then I had to put some money in, of course, my older vehicle, but that's just how we roll. But even better than that, during the windstorm, my mother was going to a Christmas party, lost her footing due to a flying open door caught in the wind, and I've been at the hospital all weekend, folks. She broke her hip. That's right. She has busted her hip up, had to have hip surgery. She's been down and out.
Right. Man, this has not been a very good Christmas holiday season so far.
This is crazy.
Luckily for me, I did, and this, I'm so glad I did. Most of the time I put off the Christmas shopping to the last minute. I don't know why I'm dumb. But this year, I had it all taken care of before, so the car blowing up and me having to get into it absolutely caused no problems.
You were good.
I already had all the Christmas gifts already bought, so I'm in the clear.
It couldn't have worked out any better if you had to do it that way.
Yeah,
so
it was awesome.
So that's kind of what we've been dealing with, folks. So if everybody's struggling, you're not alone, man. We struggle too. We work 40-plus hours a week each, every week, and then we still have to come and we do this and we hang out. So when things are going rough, it goes rough for us too, man. It's going real rough right now. But I'm going to talk about something here right quick. It has zero to do with Christmas, has zero to do with anything going on like this, but it happened near a place called Preston, Texas, back in 1904 in the month of September. This is what it was written in the Dallas Morning Herald back then. They spotted what people were calling a horse-like humanoid.
Ooh,
yeah, exactly. Goat man. Yeah, now listen, and now Lon Strickler has done a fascinating job. He has compiled a bunch of this stuff together of these centaur sightings. And listen to this, it says nearly a year ago, the people living along the riverfront near Preston were set agog by the appearance in the woods of a strange being in human form. When discovered by a party of hunters on his all fours, pawing and neighing like a horse, their attention was first attracted by what they took to be the whinnying of a startled horse in the undergrowth. When advanced upon, the strange being ran off on his hands and feet, but the pursuers gained upon him so rapidly, he sprang to his feet and, quickly covering the short distance to the river, plunged headlong from a rather high bank into the water and swam to the other side. When he reached the bank, he stood up, shook himself just like a horse coming out of a bath, and with what might really be called a horse laugh, ran off into the woods. Now, some months later, he was seen under such manner, the same conditions, but this time west of Woodville on the opposite side of the river.
A centaur.
And that says only a few weeks ago, but they didn't explain it. He said he was just acting and sounding like a horse. And it says now, written, of course, now this was written back in the early 1900s when this happened. It says only a few weeks ago, it was reported a man crawled across the road in plain view of several people not far from where the horse man was first seen but disappeared, and the pursuit began somewhat tardy. This is since Sunday. Last, the people living near Colbert, 10 miles east of Preston, in Grayson County, have been hunting for a strangely acting man who crawled about like a snake until pursued. And then he would jump to his feet and outrun the fastest horses that were ridden after him.
What? Wait a minute. Wait. Yeah. He crawls around like a snake and then springs to
his
feet?
This other guy that they say, he's belly crawling, jumps up, takes up, and horses can't catch him. It says others who pursued him by foot say that they shot at him at close range, but the bullets, if they struck him, seemed to have no effect.
Wow.
It says as late as last evening, children claim to have seen the crawling man again near the Varner place, 6 miles from Colbert. Now, it says a phone message from Colbert this afternoon confirms previous reports sent out from Durant about the state of excitement and the gathering of several parties for pursuit, but states that public interest has received something of a chill because some of the parties who were present when the close-range shots were fired say that although the peculiar being was in the open and very close, that he disappeared with the smoke of the powder. Says at the Varner place, he crawled into the hen house, and it is stated that out in the field there was a dead chicken bitten in the neck and from which there was an appearance of blood having been drawn that was found. Says though there was somewhat reduced enthusiasm, the people of the Varner neighborhood are preparing for another big roundup this afternoon or tonight. Now, this is all written back in the early 1900s.
Man. That is...
Well, what would make a man do these things anyway? You know what I mean? Like, it says horse-like humanoid. Well, he was just acting. He didn't look like a horse. You feel me? I mean, he was just... But he shakes his whole body like a horse. He whinnies.
He's a brony.
He sounds like a horse. But then they're talking about they can't catch him. You ride your horses. The fastest horses can't catch him.
You can't shoot him.
Nothing happens. And he crawls like a snake. What is that?
Well, I like how the fact that they see a guy crawling around like a snake and jumping and running around, they immediately start trying to shoot him. Like, yeah, well, right? I mean, he hasn't done anything wrong.
That they know of. It just freaks them out. It just proves that whatever scares us, that we feel threatened by it, we're just going to kill
it. Shoot it.
Let's just kill that thing. Yeah. What? Look.
And then it's sneaking into hen houses and eating chickens.
Aside
and draining the blood.
From it being a total BS move and this whole story being nothing but crap, What could that be? Just a naked dude that's just magically powered. What if...
And disappears and reappears.
Yeah, yeah.
I have no idea.
First, my first thing is I was thinking, you know, September, I don't want to be crawling around naked in Texas.
Like a snake.
Like a snake, folks. Dragging on my belly down through the... You know, no, I'm good, man. I'm good. But I saw this, I'm like, this is crazy. What is this?
Well, sticking with cryptozoology and talking about stories from the early 20th century, I've got one too, and this is about a werewolf that was spotted in the Bronx. Now, if you're not familiar with New York City is actually made up of five boroughs. And those five boroughs are, of course, the island Manhattan, the Bronx, let's see, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Those five boroughs make up New York City. Well, this took place in the Bronx. And this is actually from the December 19th, 1913 edition of the Santa Fe New Mexican. And it says, on a frosty and dark winter night, a misty coldness descended upon New York. The cold crept along the parks and the streets of the Bronx, seeping in through every crack and crevice of every respectful home scattered about. Near the Mashulu Parkway, just below the dense tree line that existed back then, something strange lurked. A creature described as a werewolf-like by those unlucky enough to have stumbled across its path at night. Even more astonishing was the fact that many were also describing a soft glow emanating from the creature. Many believed this to be just a rumor. However, one late December night, the creature stepped out of the shadows and into the sleepy streets of the Bronx. That night, the phones rang off the hooks at the Kingsbridge police station. The reports were bizarre and the callers sounded frantic. Whatever it was that the callers were reporting undoubtedly sent extra chills down their spines that cold night. A horrible deep beast, a mutated canine of sorts, with a pair of glowing eyes. However absurd or horrifying the report seemed, the Bronx precinct had a duty to venture out into the cold and investigate. That night, the Kingsbridge station sent down a few of their men to investigate the source of these frantic callers. Kingsbridge Police Captain Matt Meekon issued an alert to his squad to be on the lookout for the supposed werewolf, as well as a recent mugging that occurred near the Mashulu Parkway. While patrolling the desolate parkway, a police officer named McKiernan, came across four suspicious men who were loitering around an unlit area of the parkway. Thinking that these might be the muggers, he approached the four men. The men suddenly took off running in different directions, and a short chase ensued, ending with Officer McKiernan catching one of the suspects. As the policeman cuffed the perpetrator, a sudden sharp pain shot up the police officer's leg. Looking down at his leg, he was horrified to see what he could only describe as a phosphorus-covered hound clamping down on his boot.
What? Are you... You're kidding me.
The officer acted quickly and used his nightstick to deliver a heavy blow to the creature's skull, forcing it to release the officer's leg from its vice-like grip. A phosphorus dog...
Wait, he grabs a guy and then this dog comes out. Did the dude transform?
No, it's
or
not
did
the
it
guy.
Just show up?
Yeah, it showed up. The officer and
a glowing dog.
The officer and the perpetrator were able to get away from the glowing creature and make it back to the precinct safely. After booking the man at the station, the officer told the rest of the men of what transpired out by the parkway. Soon, a squad of men from the Kingsbridge precinct made their way to the exact spot. The beast had taken a beating from the frightened officer's nightstick. To the relief, there was no beast in sight, no glowing set of eyes, and no bulking canine dosed in a phosphorus glow. The parkway remained still, frozen, an eerie silence until the warming sun broke, a soft morning glow that pushed back the icy shadows and its eerie inhabitants for at least another day that winter in 1913. Now, this comes, like I said, from the Santa Fe, New Mexican newspaper, this account of this story that took place in the Bronx, and they're calling it the Werewolf of the Bronx. But
sounds like a hellhound.
Yeah, but a phosphorus glow to it.
What?
There was callers. People were calling the precinct over the course of a couple days. People were seeing this thing down by the parkway. So what? Like again, like you were talking in the last story. What the hell was that?
Like, what would you mistaken it for? I understand if it was a big black dog and you were like, oh, it's huge. And it turns out it's just a big German Shepherd or something.
Yeah.
I would get that. But a glowing dog, you don't see many glowing dogs. You know what I'm saying? Like, you don't come across a glowing dog every day, especially a giant glowing hellhound dog every day.
Yeah,
that's crazy. A little wild.
I thought I'd share that story because people love dog, man, and werewolf stories.
Yeah. Well, speaking of stories that you love, folks, everybody here listening surely knows when I bring up Roswell, New Mexico, right?
Yeah.
Everybody knows. Back in October, this happened. Now, this is just reported on, but back in October, I want you to listen to this. Roswell UFO drops in front of witness vehicle.
Uh-oh.
Roger
back.
Marsh wrote about this. Yeah, here it comes. Open minds. Here you go, folks. A New Mexico witness at Roswell reported a late-night encounter with a silent, triangle-shaped UFO just 20 feet ahead while driving along a main road moving out of town. Now, this is case number 80348 of the Mutual UFO Network, the witness reporting database, folks. Get out your pens and paper. Here we go. The reporting witness stated that she and her husband were driving from Albuquerque to Carlsbad and had stopped in Roswell to grab a bite to eat before continuing their journey. Now, this is back on October 24th of 2016. She says, quote, after eating, well after sunset, we headed back on the main road out of town.
Mm-hmm.
Stopping at a red light behind a couple of cars in our truck with vehicles all around us, we both noticed and said out loud that the object was coming straight towards us from the dark sky. She goes on to say that in the 2 weeks prior, we had seen lights in the sky around Albuquerque and thought this was going to be the same. But nope. Now she talks about in comparison over the right in front of them. She says this one was huge in comparison to the faraway sightings we had seen before, like the lights. And even close, she says, I didn't have time to take out my camera or to think really because I didn't want to miss what was happening. The object had lights on all ends, the front or the back, and was more triangular with bright white lights to the back or front, which was closest to us. It says it also was more rounded but still triangular, and it had a bright red, green, and blue light shining down. It was larger than our truck and appeared to be a solid object, and this thing appeared out of nowhere and was coming straight at us. I didn't know what I thought it was, and after speaking with my husband later, he described what he thought maybe an optical illusion, but then dismissed it right away because I was at a different viewpoint, and there was no mistaking it for an object of sorts. So not just lights from reflections.
Right.
So, you know, there's two different angles looking at it. We're both seeing the exact same thing. It says the object's first appearance is very close to the witness, and this is what she said. So we first noticed it being no more than 20 feet in front of us at about eye level. That slowly, at the same time, quickly, I don't know what this even means. It slowly and at the same time quickly moved right to us and then stopped and hovered right over the top of our truck.
Checking them out.
I thought I'd be able to look out the back window and continue to follow its motion, but it was nowhere in sight. And when I did, and at the same time the traffic light was turning green because the husband was driving and we started driving forward. So she figured I'll turn out and see it.
Right.
You know, that's what's going to happen. She said immediately she felt unusual. Says, I felt like I was numb. Like I didn't, that really didn't just happen. And where did this thing go? So she's already, this confusion is already setting in.
Yeah.
She said also, I didn't have time to think in the moment, but later wondered, did the other cars around us see it also? Did they see it too? Now I said that they must have, because my husband's accounts of what occurred are right in line with everything that happened. And I felt like it could have been a dream, but it was definitely real life. Now she said it all happened over a span of 5 to 7 seconds. And then she said everything kind of went back to normal. Now she does say that this was not the first experience I've had, but definitely the strangest and the one worth reporting. And I hope to have some light shed on what happened that night. I must also say that our trip home the following night, we did see a black helicopter carrying something underneath it. It was too far in the distance to fully capture what it was, and I was just exhausted thinking about all this stuff at this point. She goes on to say that I don't know where that was or what time, and it's not that, you know, an original report. She said, I just wanted to mention it. So, you know, she's not sure exactly where or what time it was that she saw that helicopter
right.
go by, but it was a black helicopter carrying something underneath it. But this story still goes back into what we discussed with the black triangles. They've taken this new triangular shape, which almost feels like we've beat this horse to death, something we've made. I mean, you
know, those in the chevrons,
you don't travel light years to need landing lights. You don't need a red, green, and blue. How would they know that's what we use? You know, unless, you know, then you really want to start twisting off in the rabbit hole is they've studied us for so long that they know that that's how we do it. So now that's how they're going
to
do it.
Extraterrestrials have to be FAA compliant as well. You know, they got to follow the
rules. You don't want to get in trouble. You don't want to get in trouble. Exactly.
Right. Well, speaking of technology, I know that people like the DARPA reports. This comes from Motherboard, and it's about the U.S. Navy's robotic boats cam are getting smarter.
Oh, great.
They say between September 6th and October 3rd, 2016, the U.S. Navy's Science and Technology Wing, basically DARPA, sent four small boats on patrol missions in the lower Chesapeake Bay. The only unusual thing was the fact that the boats were autonomous robots. Now, these robots are not like drones with humans operating them from a remote trailer in Arizona. These vessels, loaded with cameras and sensors, were more like autonomous individuals with a larger robotic collective. The Office of Naval Research, which put on the demonstration, had not ever done this before. Well, not exactly. They say in 2014, the Office of Naval Research sent 13 boats into the James River in Virginia and commanded them to swarm around vessels in different scenarios. These boats escorted friendly vessels or simulated attacks on potential enemy vehicles. But the swarm was also kind of dumb. Where one boat went, the others went too. And at the same time, each boat had to be individually determine how it would get there. 2 years later, though, in the Chesapeake now, the Office of Naval Research sent fewer boats, albeit smarter ones, that work better as a team. It says the team of Navy rigid hull inflatable boats, or RIBs, patrolled an area while watching out for incoming vessels. And when spotting one, they worked together with a shared software package called Caracas to assign a single boat to approach it, classify the type of vessel it was looking at, and then transmit that information to the rest of the swarm. At one point during the demonstration, two enemy vessels approached the swarm, one after the other, and the swarm dispatched a single boat and then a second to follow each one of the enemy boats. The remaining two boats held back. The researchers tilted the scale slightly by programming the boats in advance with imagery of enemy vehicles. But the fact that the little flotilla could spot, identify, and then track ships with individual robots is noteworthy. For one, it means it can go after multiple threats instead of just one at a time. And instead of simply escorting or attacking, the only two previous options back in 2014, this swarm now can patrol an area on its own in addition to trailing an enemy, classifying it as a good guy or a bad guy, or tracking it with sensors. In theory, the Office of Naval Research could order a boat to automatically attack a vessel identified as an enemy. But these boats, of course, in this test did not include any weapons or anything on them. But what they're saying is people aren't needed. These things can autonomously patrol a harbor or an area like that. They're able to determine what's an enemy boat, what's a friendly boat. If it's an enemy boat, they can track them. And then we can later decide, well, go ahead and attack that thing or don't attack it, but just follow it. And they're doing this all on its own. Now, Commander Luis Molina told reporters that we envision unmanned boats doing protection missions or escort missions, and we envision them doing intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance missions, really helping our ships and our sailors getting out and expanding their sphere of influence and being able to control a larger area of the ocean and determine what's going on without putting any humans in danger. So that is pretty cool. They're talking about, it goes into more about how fast the technology is growing and leap bounding and snowballing. That something that was very, very basic only 2 years ago has advanced so much in the last 2 years that they perceive this doing. Now, they're saying that they're only using it on these little inflatable boats right now for the test, but they envision moving this and escalating it to the much larger ships. So can you imagine having these autonomous attack ships or autonomous attack submarines or autonomous in conjunction with autonomous drones? Remember, we've talked about that before, where there's autonomous drones releasing other autonomous drones. I mean, it really is going to be very futuristic. You can have all these boats doing all this and protecting harbors without any people.
Yeah.
Just constantly on alert.
I don't know that I'm a fan of any of this autonomous stuff.
It's
really
scary. It reminds me of the beginning of RoboCop with the Ed 209 that goes haywire. What if you're just out on a day of sailing or boating and this autonomous
kayak fishing?
Something happens and the boat confuses you as an enemy and then just opens fire.
That's probably how I'll die. I'll die like in a bay fishing accident while I'm kayak fishing. This autonomous attack boat pops up and just guns me down.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
That'll happen.
If you'd like to watch the demonstration of the video and stuff, you can, of course, follow the show links to that over on Motherboard, and you can give that a watch. But let's take a break, folks. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about everybody's Christmas favorite, Christmas cannibals. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Go.
Cannibalism is one of the most unspeakable evils known to humanity. It's one thing to kill someone, but to eat them is something altogether different. Something unthinkable. It doesn't matter if you're a religious person or not. We all agree that killing and eating someone is probably the worst sin one can commit. Many believers and others associate cannibalism with witchcraft and worship of the devil. The fairy tale about the witch trying to eat Hansel and Gretel is a reminder of such beliefs. Those that murder others and consume their flesh are considered the worst of all criminals. Even hardened criminals recoil from such people and attempt to destroy them. For instance, notorious American cannibal Jeffrey Dahmer was murdered under suspicious circumstances while in prison, probably because his fellow inmates hated the idea of even being near him. Even Dahmer's possessions were eventually destroyed because authorities were apparently afraid of them. Cannibalism is so offensive that it always provokes a violent and emotional response, even from seemingly rational individuals. It is easy to see why people are so fascinated by cannibals. Nobody has a neutral opinion about them, and they are one of the few classes of humanity that still provokes universal hatred, even in the 21st century, and will likely always continue to do so. You don't need a home or a job to be a serial killer. Just bloodlust and a skill at picking out innocent victims. Venezuela's Durangle, or Durancel Vargas, the monster known as the Hannibal Lecter of the Andes, proved that. Vargas, the Venezuelan man-eater, was a homeless drifter who lived under a bridge in the 1990s when he killed and ate at least 20 men. Even though he was homeless, Vargas was very particular when choosing his victims. He didn't just kill and eat anyone, no. He was very mindful of his health and liked to watch his weight. After his arrest, he told reporters that he avoided eating fat people because of their high cholesterol. He didn't eat the elderly because he was afraid that they were contaminated. Yet this discernment didn't stop Vargas from killing and eating drug addicts and other derelicts. The way he killed them was also very strange. Vargas made a bamboo spear and hunted down his victims like animals. He stabbed them like a primitive tribesman hunting a wild beast. It's easy to see why Vargas earned the nickname the People Eater, or El Comegente in Spanish. There are a lot of questions about the man called the People Eater and the Hannibal Lecter of the Andes. It isn't clear where he came from or what he did before he set up shop under a bridge in a park in San Cristobal, Venezuela. There are rumors that Vargas was a former mental patient and had once been a member of a guerrilla group. Some stories indicate that Vargas was driven out of his home in the jungle as a boy because his family members thought he was possessed by evil spirits. Vargas eventually became a drifter, a drug addict, and even a heavy drinker. At some point, he found his way to San Cristobal and joined a community of homeless people that lived under a bridge. To passers-by, Vargas looked just like any other harmless derelict, a victim of a cruel society to be pitied, yet he was much worse. Vargas was basically a predator that consumed all types of meat. It isn't known how many people Vargas killed because he always preyed on the homeless. Authorities estimate his tally of victims at around 20, but it might be much, much higher. Vargas was around 40 when he was captured, and he had been drifting around for years, so there's no telling how many people he killed and ate. Vargas was a survivor and did what he had to do to survive. Vargas later told a reporter that he ate all kinds of meat, including dogs, cats, and even lizards. It's clear. He viewed human beings as just another meat, an animal to stalk, an animal to kill. Vargas also admitted to making soup out of his victim's eyes because he liked the way they tasted. He called the soup very nutritious. When a likely victim would pass by, Vargas would impale them with a homemade bamboo spear. He would then cut the victim's body up, eat the meat that he wanted, and then bury the skull, and throw the rest into the river. Many of the men who he killed and ate were drunks who came out of a dive bar near the Liberator Bridge. The worst part of Durancho Vargas' gruesome hunting ritual was that the police arrested him and let him go. That's right. In 1995, police officers were searching for a missing man who found several bodies in Vargas' hunting grounds, and they arrested Vargas, who lived in the nearby bushes. Vargas was booked, charged, and taken to court. He gave an interview for a local TV station. He even told the reporter how he spiced up the hearts of his victims and stored the meat in various containers. He also boasted that he never killed women out of a warped sense of chivalry. Despite this confession, Vargas was sent to a mental institution instead of prison, and soon after was released. Vargas returned to the exact same killing grounds and resumed the hunt. Homeless people and drunks once again started disappearing, and their friends and relatives started complaining to the police. Durancho Vargas was recaptured again in 1999 when a man named Juan Carlos Menses suffered a flat tire on the road near the Libertador Bridge. Menses got out to change the flat tire, and while he was bending over to take off the wheel, he heard shouts. Menses turned around to see a frightening sight. Vargas was just about to hit him with a baseball bat. Fortunately, a motorcycle cop pulled up and managed to subdue the man-eater before he could capture and kill his next target. Vargas was arrested and taken to the police station. Authorities didn't know what to do with him because he was obviously deranged. When he was put in a prison, everybody was afraid of Vargas, even hardened gangsters and murderers. Vargas's mental state was so confused that he was never put on trial. Instead, he was simply locked up for life. Durancho Vargas is still being held in prison in Venezuela, in solitary confinement. He won't be released, but he occasionally grants TV interviews in which he describes his cannibalism to the other reporters. It appears that the area around Libertador Bridge is finally safe now from El Comandante. The predator has already had his last hunt. Another gruesome cannibal has got to be Germany's Fritz Harman, the butcher of Hanover. Harman and his lover, Hans Granz, are believed to have kidnapped and killed as many as 37 young men and boys. They not only raped their victims, the two monsters reportedly cut up the bodies and sold the parts of their remains as meat on the black market. It is easy to see why Fritz Harman earned the nickname the Vampire of Hanover. Now, in an earlier show, here on Expanded Perspectives, I did a story on the Vampire of Sincota. In many ways, the stories are similar. But unlike Bela Kish, Fritz Harman killed only males. He was a complete predator who not only used his victims for sex, he also exploited them in every way possible. Harman stole the victims' clothes, their personal possessions, and sold them all for quick cash. He and Granz even ran a butcher shop to cover up their gruesome activities. Harman was able to get away with his crimes because he operated in Germany just after the end of World War I. The end of the war in 1918 brought chaos to the nation because the German Empire had collapsed. There was open fighting in the streets between the communist and various right-wing gangs that would eventually unite into the Nazi Party. Such a vacuum made a perfect environment for a monster such as Harman to operate openly. Before World War I, Fritz Harman was an ordinary man and a seemingly harmless petty criminal. Harmon was a lousy student, and he was apparently gay. Harmon was arrested for child molestation in 1898, but was found insane and sent to a mental institution instead of prison. Eventually, Harmon returned to Germany and lived a fairly ordinary life. He served in the German army and worked with his father in the family business. Harmon was arrested again after a violent fight with his father. After the business failed, he slipped into a depression. He began to drink and turned into a petty crook, a con artist, in order to make ends meet. Harmon became a small-time thief and the lowest form of criminal life, a police informer, a rat. He tried to avoid arrest by ratting out his fellow criminals, and by the time Germany entered World War I, Harmon was serving prison, time for fraud. He was released in 1918 to a very different Germany. When Harmon walked out of prison in 1918, he found himself in a completely different nation. Germany had been defeated. Its swaggering empire, Kaiser Wilhelm II, had relinquished his throne and ran away to exile in Holland. A socialist government had signed a humiliating treaty of surrender to the victorious Allies, and the nation was gripped by poverty. Millions of Germans were going hungry because of the starvation blockade in which the British Royal Navy stopped ships from hauling food to Germany or any neutral country that bordered Germany. The blockade was left in place after the war to force Germany to submit to the humiliating Peace of Versailles. Germany was suffering a serious food shortage because of this blockade. Everyday food items, including meat, were in very short supply. Meat, in particular, was fetching a fortune on the black market. So, Harmon and Granz decided to take advantage of the situation by opening a butcher shop. Like many petty criminals in post-World War I Germany, Harmon made extra money by selling black market meat under the counter. Harmon was able to provide his customers with lamb and beef, which were both in short supply. The problem was where he got them. You see, he wasn't really selling beef or lamb. He was selling humans. Germany at the time was filled with homeless young men, many of them veterans. These men drifted around, and some of them turned to prostitution in order to support themselves. Harmon began picking up the young men up in train stations and taking them back to his butcher's shop. One of the runaways was Hans Granz, who eventually became Harmon's accomplice and lover. The two reportedly killed the victims by biting them through the throat. This is one of the reasons he was dubbed the Vampire of Hanover. The victims were also sodomized. Since the men submitted to this treatment, they were probably drugged or knocked unconscious. After the terrible two were done with their fun, they cut up the victims and threw the parts they couldn't sell into the nearby Lean River. They may have also burned some body parts in a stove in the apartment for heat. Fritz Harmon thought he could get away with the crimes because he was a police informer, after all. He ratted out other crooks to cops who would ignore his activities. The police probably didn't suspect what Harmon was doing, although perhaps they should have. In September 1918, the police raided Harmon's apartment and found a naked 17-year-old there. Harmon was arrested, charged with sexual assault, and served a short jail time, but was then released to resume his activities. The vampire was eventually caught when children playing near the river found a human skull that had washed up. Other remains began washing up, so the police dragged the river and found 500 bones from 22 different bodies. Since the skeletons were those of young men, police began to suspect Harmon and Granz, who had been seen with a number of young men that also later disappeared. The police raided Harmon's apartment on June 22, 1924. Now, they didn't find any bodies, but they did find clothes and other personal items the two had stolen from some of their victims. Harmon was arrested and quickly confessed to raping, murdering, and butchering young men since 1918. He didn't confess to cannibalism or the selling of meat. Harmon's trial became a media circus in the 1920s, and the press and observers were at a loss for words. The crimes were unspeakable, and the phrase serial killer hadn't yet entered the vocabulary. Instead, reporters used such terms as werewolf, vampire, and even wolfman to describe Harmon. Harmon was found guilty of 24 murders on December 19, 1924, and was beheaded with a guillotine on April 15, 1925. The guillotine was then still the preferred method of execution in Germany, as well as in France. Hans Granz was sentenced to 12 years in prison. He served his full sentence, was released, and lived in Hanover until his death in 1975, 50 years after the vampire's execution. I don't think anyone can argue that serial killers are among the most heinous of all criminals, and cannibals are perhaps even worse. But most of these predators are preying on people they don't know. A pretty young girl, or a desperate young boy just trying to get by. But what about a special type of killer? One that kills and eats someone very close to them. A relative, a sibling, or perhaps even their own children. The most repulsive cannibal of all may be Klára Maurová, a resident of the Czech Republic, who skinned her own 8-year-old son alive. Witnesses later told a court that Maurová had then fed her son's skin to relatives after skinning him alive. To add to the horror, the boy apparently lived through the horror to tell about it afterwards. The cannibal cult mother kept her victims alive so she could keep torturing him. Maurová, who was supposedly a member of a cult, held her children hostage in the basement and tortured them. She even installed a baby video monitor so she could watch and torture and abuse from her own kitchen. To make matters worse, several other members of Maurová's family supposedly participated in the abuse. News reports indicate that Maurová even turned her closet into a sort of makeshift dungeon so she and her relatives could torture and cannibalize the children. The horrors were particularly reprehensible because Maurová and her family claimed to be part of a Christian religious movement. There's quite a bit of mystery about Maurová's family horrors that occurred in Kyrum in the Czech Republic back in 2008. What facts are known are pretty gruesome. Two boys, 7 and 8 years old, were chained in a cellar and a closet by their mother, Klára Maurová, and at least one other relative, Babora Skrilova. The boys were kept locked up for months. They were burned with cigarettes, beaten, and starved. The mother reportedly gagged one of the boys to keep him from screaming. At one point, during the horrors, Klára reportedly cut off pieces of the 8-year-old's skin and fed them to his brother. Court testimony indicates she may have fed the skin to other relatives as well. Obviously disturbed, no one knows why she did it. The motives for the gruesome abuse are unknown. But news reports indicate that the women may have been involved in something called the Grail Movement cult. The movement, which apparently worships the Holy Grail, is based in Austria, and its members preach the Grail message. Some online accounts deny that the Grail movement was involved and state that the movement's involvement with the Czech cannibalism case was a hoax that was apparently perpetuated by British tabloid journalists. Some local media reports indicate that the torture was directed by a sinister figure called the Doctor. The Doctor was apparently the leader of the cult. This has never been confirmed, and the Doctor has never been identified or caught. It's not known if this cult is part of the formal Grail movement or some sort of breakaway movement, and there's no evidence to support the claims that the Doctor exists or is involved in more abuse. Court testimony revealed that the boys were sexually abused. The same testimony stated that they were made to stand in their own urine for days on end. Worst of all, Klára Maurová was apparently watching the abuse over a baby monitor. You see, That's how she got caught. Ironically enough, the high-tech tool that Clara Maurova used to watch the horrors she was inflicting on her own children actually led to her capture. The system she used consisted of a camera that relayed video via a radio signal. Well, one day a neighbor installed a similar device in order to monitor his infant in the crib. When he turned on his monitor, the neighbor got a full view of Maurova's horror show. He quickly called the police, who came over to take a look. When the officers saw what was going on, they raided the Maurova home and rescued the boys from the homemade dungeon. During the raid, Clara Maurova was arrested. Clara Maurova was convicted and sentenced to 9 years in prison in October 2008. She is still presumably serving her sentence in prison, and her sons are hopefully with another family. News reports indicate that another woman named Katerina, who might be Clara's sister, was sentenced to 10 years in prison for her role in the torture. Many of the questions surrounding the cannibal cult horror have never been answered, yet Clara Maurova and her accomplices created a new level of horror, even in the world of cannibalism. Worst of all, they figured out how to commit cannibalism and torture without committing murder. A new set of laws had to be developed just to charge her with her crimes. Whatever sentences they created for her won't really matter. Nothing can make up for the torture she performed on her own children. One can only hope there's a special place in hell for Clara Maurova. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
And we're back with Expanded Perspective. Some of these stories are chilling. I mean, we've talked about serial killers before, whether it's the Vampire of Sinkota, or are there some of the other ones? You know, there's one thing to kill people, but there's a completely different type of killer when it comes to cannibalism. And it's just like some of these people, they somehow they get pleasure of eating their victims. I always think back to Hannibal Lecter. Remember when he in the movie, when Anthony Hopkins like invites his friends over for dinner and he's actually feeding them humans?
Yeah.
He somehow is getting some kind of a thrill from doing
some sort
that.
Of pleasure from it.
And the story I talked about were the two guys. You know, this was post-World War I. Food was scarce. They didn't have much food, and they owned a butcher shop. And what people were coming in there and getting steaks and lamb stuff, well, what they thought was that. But actually, they were getting humans. They just figured out a way to market. We ain't got no cows or goats to slaughter. Let's just kill these homeless people, these wanderers, and we'll just serve it up. And I guess people were so hungry that you were like, man, this meat tastes weird, but you know what? We're starving, so I'm not even going to question it. It's better than nothing. They never once thought that it could be human beings they were eating.
They're eating long pig.
And it also, I mean, they talked about them being arrested, and then the police kind of let them go, and then it turned out they were doing it again. It almost seemed like the police didn't care either.
Don't you like that they went back to it? They're like, eh.
They're just getting rid of the riffraff, you know, these wanderers and stuff, you know.
Maybe they liked eating there. The police were like, it's really not that bad.
I don't know. And, of course, the most chilling is the woman who were eating her own children. Of course, she didn't kill them. She was just, like, skinning them and feeding them their own skin and stuff. And the only reason she got caught was with a baby monitor. Because I remember, I don't know how they are now because my kids are grown, or mostly Luke's five now. But when the twins were real little, I remember having one of those video monitors. And that's what she was doing. They were all chained up down in the basement. And she had a video monitor where she could keep tabs on them, and it was worked by radio waves. And that one of the neighbors bought a monitor too and accidentally started picking it up, and that's when he called the cops. That's how she got busted. They had no idea that she was doing this.
That's insane.
Man, that is
Crazy Christmas Cannibal.
Terrible, terrible. Christmas cannibals, right?
Christmas cannibals.
Yeah.
Love them or hate them, you got to have them around, don't you? The Christmas cannibals. That's a good name of the band. We're going to go ahead and copyright that band name. Kyle Filson and the Christmas Cannibals.
Yeah, that's a good one. Let's talk real quickly about our sponsor.
Gaia is a video streaming service, much like Hulu or Netflix, where you sign up and you have access to thousands of films, thousands of documentaries, yoga lessons, and things like that. It is very interesting. Gaia.com, G-A-I-A.com. And I like the Seeking Truth area of the service. They have different documentaries and films about all kinds of things. And I recently started watching one that I find very interesting called UFOs and Nukes, The Secret Link Revealed. And we've interviewed Robert Salas on this show, who actually worked at Maelstrom Air Force Base when he was down in those nuclear silos down in the ground. And now he never saw the UFOs himself, but the guards at the tower and at the gates and stuff were calling down there, telling them that they were seeing these strange-looking UFOs flying around, and they lost control of the nuclear missiles. Whatever these objects were had seized control of the instruments, and they were unable to launch or do anything for a period of minutes. It's very scary, and that's what this show is about. Over the past four decades, researcher Robert Hastings has interviewed more than 150 veterans about the same type of thing. There where these ICBMs mysteriously are malfunctioning for moments right after disc-shaped craft were observed hovering near these underground launch silos. Let's take a listen.
The invention of nuclear weapons. For the first time, all-out warfare risked not only the destruction of civilization, but the radioactive poisoning of the planet itself. Mankind's future never looked bleaker. Evidence uncovered by researchers confirms that technologically advanced observers, whose identity and intentions remain unknown, began to monitor the nuclear standoff almost from the start.
As this object passed over the missile site, we would start getting erratic indications on that missile. The bad thing was we also got a launch indicator.
My name is David Shinley.
My name's Galen King. I'm a retired Air Force Major.
My name is Chris Fenstermacher.
John Earnshaw.
Philip Moore. And I have given permission for the things that I have to say to be used in this production.
The UFO did, in fact, shut down several missile silos in Montana.
Strange lights in the sky making odd maneuvers.
5 to 6 oblong lights stacked on top of one another just outside the gate.
Big white object that was cigar-shaped.
And said, sir, for lack of a better description, it was a flying saucer hovering over that missile.
That object did things that no airplane, helicopter, or any other system that we had in existence could do.
It fired a beam of light at the warhead, and he said, Lieutenant Jacobs, you are never to speak of this again. It never happened.
There you go. If you're interested in UFOs and things like that, then you should definitely check out Gaia.com. There's tons of stuff over there, over 7,000 videos. Signing up is easy. They offer 3 plans. Signing up, if you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. After that, it'll be $9.95 a month. Or you can sign up for a 3-month plan, and they have an annual plan. And if you buy the annual plan, of course, it's cheaper. It's $7.95 a month. If you're a fan of the stuff we talk about on this show, then you definitely would be a fan of Gaia. .com. Christmas is coming up. Perhaps you could buy a subscription for someone that's interested in these types of things. Gaia.com, G-A-I-A.com.
I'd like to mention, if you'd like to share some of your own stories, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can always call the show, 817-945-3828. I hope everybody out there has a great Christmas. This is the time of year where a family is important. And, just get out there and have fun. Take some photographs. Give somebody a hug. Let them know that you think about them. Know that you love them. Cam, you're going to be stuck with your mother all week long leading up to Christmas. I know you're not necessarily looking forward to that. But several years from now, when she's long gone, you'll think back to this one week and be like, you know what? I had a really
good time. Yeah.
Good time. Because when's the last time you spent a whole week with your mother?
It's been a long time. Yeah, exactly. It's been a while. And that's something else, folks. I think the best gift you can give somebody is just your time. Because, that is the most precious. So if you've got somebody there, you know, elderly people that you're going to be spending time with, or even, you know, kids or somebody younger than you and all that. Just spend some time with them. Just have a little fun. Set it down. I'm the same way. I don't like...
Yeah, everybody gets busy with their lives. Yeah.
But you know what? You really think about it, too. It's like that's the thing to do.
And several people can't get home for the holidays. I understand that. But today's technology with Skype and FaceTime and now Facebook, you can do live streaming.
Yeah.
There's no reason why you can't somehow get in touch with your loved ones. Talk to them for just a little bit. Check in on them, especially if it's somebody you live far away and you don't really see how they're doing. It's good to just, you know, just check up on them. I think
exactly.
It's
yeah, very important. Exactly.
So I hope everybody out there has a great Christmas. And we'll be speaking to you elite members on Thursday. And for everybody else, we'll be speaking to you again next Monday. For Inner Traditions, New Page Books, Anomalist Books, Ancient American Magazine, and Pretty Lights, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hitt.
Peace, y'all.
I'm brand new, I'm a big and tall. I'm in the line, I run it.